Cloud Townsend Resources Incorporated presents What is Good Christian Therapy? There are some times in life when therapy is just what the doctor ordered. If you have decided you could benefit from therapy, how do you know how to evaluate good therapy? What are the realistic goals and how does time play an important role? Join us and you will learn what to consider and how to evaluate this process. You're joining a recorded presentation with a live audience. And now your speaker, Dr. John Townsend.
Good evening. The topic tonight is what is good Christian therapy? And it's an important topic because there's lots of good Christians that do bad therapy. And there's lots of non-Christians that do pretty good therapy. And there's lots of yo-yos. And so it's a lot of confusion out there about the whole counseling process. How many of you have ever considered going getting some counseling? I'm not saying you've done it because you'd be shame-based. That's great. That's just about everybody. And if you didn't raise your hand, you're the reason that they went to get counseling. We're talking tonight about the specific aspect of therapy, and I'm being specific about that because this topic tonight has been one that a million people have asked about. Is do you have some sort of a framework for good therapy? So this is not about the process itself. In other words, Monday Night Solutions is part of the growth process. You know, you come here and you learn things and you chat about them and you try to pick up somebody and all those good things. Remember the boundaries and dating seminars coming up. If you're married and your spouse wants to go to that seminar, you might want to think about that problem. But Wednesday night, like Jim Gaffney's recovery groups that he calls now, well, I love that title, Wednesday night applications, that's part of the process too. And then there's another part which has to do with seeing a specific person who's got formal training in certain aspects of human function and breakdowns. And that's what we're centering on tonight. So it's going to be a little bit technical, but not really, because it all has to do with the growth process. But I wanted to begin by telling a story about something that happened to me a long, long time ago when a pastor friend of mine were going to go hear some Christian therapists talk about their trade. And I was friends with him. We just had done a lot of things. Good person. We sort of like enjoyed the same things in life. So we went to hear people talk about the process. And I remember one guy got up there and talked about what he did, his specialties and his training. And he was really, I thought, theologically accurate. He had the chapters and verses down and kind of made very precise sense. But he was a little on the cold side, kind of reserved. But you thought, you know, he passes the doctrine test. And then a lady came up who sort of was a little lost theologically. I mean, she knew what she believed, but she couldn't really articulate it. She couldn't find, you know, the book of Hezekiah or anything. But I thought she was really warm, and she could tell that she cared, and she had a lot of depth, a lot of personal depth. And I kept thinking in my head, I wonder what my buddy's thinking here. Like, you know, which one would he go to? Because he really understood his theology and was very conservative and really understood the Bible. So we're driving away, and I said, well, what do you think about these two? And he goes, oh, I would go to the woman by far. And I was really surprised because he was a real chapter and verse kind of guy. And I said, why? He said, because I was safe with her. He said, I felt like not only anything I said was going to be accepted and dealt with, and I wasn't going to be judged, but I also felt like she could feel feelings for me that I couldn't feel for myself, which is one of the marks of a good therapist, if you've ever had any time in the field, is that part of the job is helping a person by containing aspects of themselves that they are unable to tolerate, that you are unable to grieve or fear or feel or experience or even talk about or even be aware of. They're there like a parent, like a good mommy, saying, I can deal with this, and my being able to deal with this and talk about this black whole part of you means in time you'll be able to deal with this. The therapist bears what cannot be borne in the person. And it always kind of helped me to understand what people really need, because I really had misjudged my friend. Is that, and I'm not saying one person was right or wrong, I'm just saying, if you've got to go with something, if the person isn't able to be emotionally present, they're not going to do you a lot of good. If they don't show up when you show up, if you know what I mean, there's not a lot going to be happening. Now, I thought later, you know, that was a good experience, though, of the whole split in the Christian counseling world. That there's people who know a lot of truth and a lot of theology and a lot of doctrine, a lot of research, but they're sort of cold fish. Not by, you know, choice. They just, you know, they'd rather be on the internet than talking to you right then. And then there's people who are really into connection and relationship and getting down deep, but they sort of don't know their theology very well. Like the old joke about how to pick a person to date applies. You know, like, how should I pick a person to date in terms of spiritual values? Well, if the person is really, really ugly, they should have like 3 degrees in theology and go evangelizing twice a week and have 17 spiritual gifts. Now, if the person's really, really good looking, they need to believe in a higher being. That's kind of how you figure out the formula. Well, not really, but that had something to do with my thinking. Is you need a person who was integrated, who has both the aspects of that guy, who knew his stuff, but he just really couldn't connect, and somebody who can really connect, but sure was kind of fuzzy in her thinking. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to talk about kind of a, not a checklist, because I don't like that term, but I would say more a way of looking at the Christian therapy process. And part of that's going to be looking at Christian therapists too, because they're so involved. The person is so much involved in this process. If you could get well by reading a book, the therapist wouldn't have to be important. If you could get well by going to a seminar on Monday night, and obviously that hasn't worked because you're still here. So there's got to be the person is it's kind of like God's handiwork here. So let me go over some of the different aspects of this. Number one, in an ideal sense, what would be the best possible thing of all would be to have someone who was competent and Christian. And Christian, by that I mean not only in their faith but in their practice, that what they do is biblical in nature. Now, let me ask you a thought question. What if you've got somebody who is, so that's number one, the ideal. Now let's drop down to reality. What if you got somebody who's competent and just not Christian or not really, not explicitly Christian, or somebody who's Christian and is kind of lost? Who would you pick? Most of us would pick the competent person. Why is that? Because you're all a bunch of faithless people, and that's important to know. You would pick the competent, and I would pick the competent because somewhere inside of you, you know that if God designed you, and if God designed the repair process and the growth process, then that person may know something, that competent person, about God's design. May not know God very well, but may know something about how he has designed what it takes to grow up and restore and repair and all these sorts of things. In other words, there's almost a faith issue involved that if a person does good work, they're doing something right. They're bearing good fruit. Remember how Philippians talks about some people proclaim Christ with bad motives? He says, but I don't care, Christ is proclaimed. Kind of the same idea. The good things happen. And good things don't happen in people's hearts unless God's around. Third choice is a Christian. You know, at least, you know, if they're no good, at least you can, like, sing psalms together and that sort of thing. And then the fourth is a yo-yo. And you don't want that at all. That's a person who's got neither. So, everybody, I mean, I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of Christian therapists back in the days when Henry and I were running psychiatric units and clinics all up and down the West Coast. And so we've had a lot of practice in sort of like where people are in this, and we had a pretty structured interview process. And the good thing about it is that there's a lot of these out there, a lot of confident Christians out there. And so this isn't like any kind of a witch hunt. I'm really happy that there are now, 20 years ago, I probably couldn't have said that. But these days, there are a lot of people who've gotten good formal training or have gotten good training and then went and got spiritual stuff integrated or whatever. But there's a lot of good help out there, especially, you know, in urban areas of America and that sort of thing. So that's good. Let me give a definition of what Christian therapy is then, or a good Christian therapy or whatever, because we need to understand what this is really about. Basically, good Christian therapy is about what we call the sanctification process. It is an active and specific involvement in your sanctification. In other words, it's not about restoring innocence. It's about restoring redemption. You know, people sometimes come to counseling because they want to get things back that they lost, like that backmasking country song. You get your truck back, you get your mom back, you get your dog back. If you play it backwards. And some people come in for that. Like, I want to get all restored totally the way I used to be and life the way it used to be. And the Bible wasn't written that way. It wasn't about getting us back before the garden. It's getting us back to what's called a redeemed state. We've been bought back. We're not so innocent anymore, but we are integrated. And integration, actually, is a higher state than innocence. Innocent people still make the same mistakes again. You ever innocently dated the wrong person 20 different times? We call that a zero learning curve. And you might want to check and see if somebody during the middle of the night gave you a lobotomy or something. Check into these things because innocence is not that great. What is great is being integrated and being able to understand good and bad and truth and lies and love and hate and those sorts of things. Well, God has a process of taking us from a broken and hurting and dysfunctional state, whether there be depression or anxiety, or a drug addiction, or a substance abuse, or a relational issue, or a food problem, or a thought problem, mood problem, all those sorts of things that the psychiatric and psychological literature address. He designed a process called sanctification, which was to restore us back to the functioning state we needed to be in. And that's what therapy is part of. In other words, your therapy should fit in your spiritual life. It shouldn't be this part that doesn't make sense. Like, I'm going to church and I'm learning this stuff, and then I go to therapy and I learn this stuff. And some people have had that experience. You know, they'll go to a church and they'll hear, do the word, do what it says. Everything's going to be okay. Trust and obey. And they go to therapy and it's like, hug your inner child. And it's like, what? How can my child trust and obey? Somehow it should fit in your head conceptually because God is integrated into your growth process. Because if you've got an issue that's severe enough and troublesome enough to make you go to the time and trouble and expense of looking for a professional, that means that there's a specific area in your growth process that's stuck or injured, or there's a lack there or an immaturity there, or there's an emptiness. In other words, somewhere you've got a handicap in becoming part of the image of God. And that's what therapy does. It's very specific. In other words, it's not just sort of like encouraging you to grow. It goes deep inside to where you're not growing. You've got somebody who, for example, has a depression. You find out the depression was really about loss. And a person couldn't grieve, and they couldn't let go, and it wasn't okay, and they didn't want to feel the bad feelings and all these sorts of things. So they stayed busy all their life and became a rescuing workaholic helper. I'm sure you don't know anybody like that. And then all of a sudden they turned 34 and they collapsed, or they ate a million donuts, or they whatever. And they went and said, I can't control myself. And you find out that's right, willpower fails. And then you specifically, in the therapeutic process, begin working on what is it about loss that hurts so bad? What is it about loss that you cannot do what Jeremiah says of going into and becoming like the weeping and wailing women? What is it about loss that is so painful that you cannot become a person entering the house of mourning that Ecclesiastes talks about. See what I mean by specific? That's what I mean about it's an active and specific part. So it fits, and it should fit. You know, if you're going to a healthy church and a healthy counselor, you should see some similarities between what you're seeing. So really, tonight, as we're going over these elements, think about your church, too. Think about your support group. Think about the people you hang around with. Some of you hang around people that require going to a support group. Now, that means two nights a week. You hang around somebody that makes you become a psychotic maniac on Tuesdays, and so Wednesdays you have to go to a psychotic maniac anon group to recover from that. I mean, kind of begin evaluate. It's not a being judgmental or condemning to evaluate the people you're with. And everybody in your life that you depend on for some reason should be part of these things, these good things that go in the Christian therapy process. Here are some of the specific things that I want you to be able to think about and look at then in this process. And by the way, always remember Matthew 7, what Jesus said about this. He said, "It ain't easy." In the Greek, that's... He said in verse 13, "Enter through the narrow gate. Wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction. Many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it." And I believe that people that take the time and trouble and investment to go get Christian therapy. And by the way, I know some people that have gone because they just wanted a better life. And I know some people that waited until they were at death's door to finally admit they needed help. And I think those who are in the first group are kind of be better off. But don't ever think that good Christian therapy is Epcot or Disneyland or a love bath. If you've ever done good Christian therapy work, it's work, isn't it? And you look at stuff that you don't want to look at, and you admit stuff you don't want to admit, and you confront stuff that you don't want to confront, and you take responsibility for much more than you ever dreamed you would take responsibility for. But that's what the narrow gate is about. And there are a lot of people that go in for a few sessions and say, "This is not for me." And God bless them. They need to go out and probably, you know, eat out of dumpster dumpsters for a while until they get enough pain to go back in. But it's not about going in and getting loved into health. And if you've ever had one of those experiences, I have people tell me this. I say, "Well, I went to see somebody, and all they did was nod, just affirm." You know, like the little dog in the back of your car? Must have been, wow, really? Well, that's what we call grace without much truth. And you can, you know, go get the dog. You can get them at Walmart for $3, and they have a little spring on their head, and they work fine for a long time. And so that is a necessary element. But if all you're getting is the uh-huh and the affirmation and everything's okay, you're subject to license from what the Bible says. Now, the other end of that is the controlling Nazi therapist. You know, you walk in and you say, "Hi," and they say, "Here's your problem." You say, "You don't know my name yet." Well, that's a lot of truth and not much grace. You got to have both. But the point is, if it's good therapy, I hate to tell you this, but it's going to hurt. It's not going to be an anesthetic. In fact, it will cause sometimes more pain than you thought that you were in when you first came in. But that's just because God's solution for the wrong kind of pain is giving us the right kind of pain. The pain of finally becoming an honest person. The pain of finally allowing ourselves to be vulnerable. And to open up and to make a connection with him and other people. And some of us, it's like throwing alcohol on a wound. And it burns. But you know, God is not averse to that kind of pain. He experienced much worse than that. Because lack of pain is not the goal. If you go to Christian therapy to get out of pain, you might as well just go be an addict. Because there's got to be some sort of crucifixion of parts of us that need to die or to be reborn. And then what happens is we grow. Growth comes out of that furnace. But kind of don't think it's going to be all fun because we had a bad life. it's going to be a lot of work, and then we have a growth life. Okay, that's really depressing, so let's talk about... I'm sorry, forget it all. You need a touchy-feely person, okay? Forget it. Speaking of the person, here's some aspects of the person. This is kind of goes without saying, but a lot of times we have to remember it. Make sure they're credentialed. Witch doctors really don't cut it, and people that can't pass certain licensure and kind of tests and these sorts of things. Would you go to an attorney who said, I got a license as a plumber, I couldn't pass the bar, but, you know, I'll take your case. No, you're not going to do that. And all 50 states have certain credentialing processes and certain licenses. Make sure that whatever it is in your state, the person has done, the person's been accountable to somebody, okay? Also, make sure that, remember I meant they could be present. It's just really critical. You're just not going to open up to a person who can't show up emotionally. In other words, and I don't believe in like being able to grill your therapist and say, well, what losses have you had? Like, has your Dalmatian ever had cancer? Mine has. How can you understand my, you know, I don't believe that. That's why I don't believe, you know, you got to have a married therapist to understand a married person or a female versus a male. I think you got to have an integrated person who's had enough life experiences that you can tell they can be present these things. You want a person who, that was the third part, is integrated. In other words, they've lived life. And again, I don't believe in taking a person through what their life experiences were. I don't think that's appropriate. I think you can find out a lot about a lot of other areas to give you what you need. And also a person who has a good reputation. If the only person that really likes your, you know, and when you check out, likes your counselor, are people in straitjackets, it's probably not the best idea. But ask around to healthy pastors and healthy other counselors and, you know, people that you think are pretty normal and balanced. And you find out, because the good ones stay around a long time and do really good work, and the bad ones either develop a cult or they move. And so you'll either got somebody unbalanced who loves this person and, or, you know, they just move to another state to get away from certain legal proceedings. So reputation's important. All right. Let's talk about their view, or now let's talk about the process of Christian therapy a little bit, about the Bible. Now, there's a lot of talk about that, like, well, you know, how much of the Bible needs to fit in and all these sorts of things. And basically, the thing to look at is that I believe when somebody claims, see, there's some Christians that will go, I'm a Christian, but I don't do Christian therapy, I do good therapy, and I just haven't had the opportunity or resource to do formal training of what that means. I think that that's, I respect that statement because it means they're not trying to shine anybody on. And I would say, let's look at your work and look at, you know, what we believe about our faith and see how the work could be, because it could be good work if it's sound. But if they claim to be not a Christian who does good work, but a person who does good Christian work, then they're making a certain claim, and I think the standard's been raised a little bit when they say that. When they say that, how does it fit, how does their work fit with theology, with doctrine? It is a fair question when somebody says, yeah, I do Christian therapy. Can you tell me a little bit about that? I mean, don't take them through the barbecue pit, but just tell me how that fits. Because either person will understand what we're talking about and talking about, well, the fact that, you know, because of the fall, we are all broken, and so God puts certain elements of relationship and accountability and depth and grace and forgiveness to bring us to another. You know, they understand what we talk about. Like, you've got 500 solutions tapes that kind of take you through this. Or they do a thing we call scotch taping, which means they'll say, oh, what I mean is, you know how the Bible says God helps those that help themselves? It's kind of where I am. Well, go look up that verse for a second. It will take you a while. It's not in the Bible. And so kind of watch out for a scattered kind of patchworky, here's a verse there, here's a verse there. Look more for people that understand what the Bible calls the whole counsel of God. Do they see the Bible as a whole with certain deeper themes and principles and those sorts of things? That they thought through these issues. Do they have, whatever their approach, because, you know, if you've studied Christian or any kind of counseling at all, there's a million approaches. There's behavioral and analysis and gestalt and existential and humanistic and Rogerian, and there's probably 2 million shrinks in the country and 3 million theories, so there's a lot. Whatever their theory is, number one, do they have one? Hey, a lot of people don't. How many of you went through a period in your life where you knew you were a Christian but didn't know your system of belief? You didn't know whether Jesus was coming back on a Tuesday or a Thursday, or if at all, or if that was just a metaphor, or what you believed about church doctrine, or what you believed about the Holy Spirit. I mean, so it's something everybody's got to study. Do they have a theory? And what we would call an approach. And is that theory consistent with the Bible? Is that theory friendly? Is it friendly to research? See, I believe, like the system that we talk about on solutions, you know, the things that Henry and I write about. By the way, a lot of this material can be found, in, if you need more information, from our book, 12 Christian Ideas That Will Make You Crazy. We have a lot of these thoughts in here. And also the book, and this is strange, but also the book, Raising Great Kids. Because Raising Great Kids, if you think about it, is a book about character development. Well, the therapeutic process is about character repair and giving people developmental parts of themselves they never had the first time around. So on a conceptual level, that's a resource. And I believe that, you know, like in our system, we developed it from lots and lots of Bible study, but we also appreciated the research that illuminates what was already in God. I believe that all you really need, it's all in the Bible, but I really believe that research helps to understand it and to illuminate what's there and to support it. And if the person sort of poo-poos research or whatever, it's not very important. It's kind of like the Christians, you know, that say everything in our culture is bad and just all they want to do is go to church 3 nights a week. They're kind of weird. Rather than people that say, yeah, I can get some good things out of our culture. Sure, it's fallen, but they don't have an adversarial stance with research. They have a, hey, all truth is God's truth kind of stance. If it's true, it's going to hold up to the Bible. Specifically now about their approach, about a good Christian therapeutic approach, here's some of the things to look at and begin to clarify. What number am I on, 3 or 4? I'm on number 4. That they'd be able to count, it's very, very important. An inner world orientation. Good Christian therapy has an orientation to the inner world. It is not stuck on external behavior. I remember when I was in practice a long time ago, and a woman came in and she had an eating disorder. It was a horrible one. It was almost, you know, lethal. And I said, have you ever gotten help for this before? And she said, yeah, I did. I said, who'd you see? She said, she named a Christian therapist. I said, well, what did he tell you? She said, well, he said it was a sin. And I said, so what did he tell you to do about that sin? She said, well, he told me to stop doing it. And I said, so you didn't stop? She said, no, I kept doing it. So what did he say when you kept doing it? He said, well, he told me, he sort of already told me what to do, so he couldn't see me anymore. Now, there are a lot of Christians out there, not therapists, that are doing that. You know, be good. If you're not, I'm going to tell you again, then I've all washed my hands of you, and, you know, you've gone down the tubes. Well, the fact was, sure, she had a behavior that had some sinful aspects to it, but there were horribly destructive things within her heart driving that behavior. Like, she was a person who always let people control her. And she was sort of the nice guy. She was sort of the jellyfish of the world and felt like she owed it to everybody to say yes. And so the only thing that she could control in her whole life was, guess what? Her eating, food. And so she was literally starving herself to death. Actually, she was bulimic. She had both, which was kind of a, you know, when they a person takes in so much and then they get rid of it in an, what we call an ambivalent attempt to work out a problem in a relationship. But she needed somebody to get inside her soul and figure out why she was so afraid that if she got close to somebody, she would be controlled. How many of you have had that problem? Almost all of us have had the problem of deeply caring about someone else and trusting them so much and investing in them so much, and then giving that person all kinds of power and choices and influences over us that they never should have in the name of love, and then have gotten your bladder kicked by that person because you became too dependent on that person. That's an inner world orientation, and she needed to do a lot of soul work to find out why she was afraid of love and why she couldn't take control and all these sorts of things. Jesus talks about that when he says to take a look at the cup and what's inside that cup. And before you wash the outside of the cup, which is your soul, get inside there where it's dirty. And so a good therapy process has got to look at the behaviors that struggle you. If it's depression or alcohol or anxiety, of how, you know, sometimes it's so severe you've got to go get something like a very strict regimen and a structure to kind of get it under control and then work on the inside. Some people isn't so severe, so they can work on the inside to begin with. But they need to be paying attention to the inner world and the outer world. There are some, for example, that are only inner world. And you come in and you say, well, I just, you know, I've lost my job and my wife and my dog and all my money. And they say, yeah, but what's it like inside? Well, they're kind of rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic then. So they've got to be able to look at both outside and inside. Huh? What happened to that woman? The one that had the eating disorder? She learned how to hold on to herself when she felt loving feelings through a hard process, so that when she became close to someone, she could keep her freedom and what we call her autonomy, and she wouldn't give parts of herself over to people that like her power and choices and responsibilities. And she resolved it and came to a fine weight, and as far as I know, she's doing fine. People do that every day. Also, in terms of this inner world orientation, a person's got to have, a process has got to have certain values. In other words, especially in our faith, Christian therapy needs to have certain values. What are some very important values you think are critical that everybody have in the room, you and the therapist or your significant other and you or your mate or whatever? What are some things you've got to all agree on? Honesty, trust, the truth, integrity, God, His help, the value of love, the value of relationship. In other words, it's not whatever. There are certain things are right and wrong, and we believe and we disbelieve, and they should be part of the process. In other words, values-free therapy is a joke. The research has already said it doesn't exist. The therapist's values do affect the therapy. And so that's why it's a good thing in a Christian session to talk about what's right and what's wrong, because the rights and the wrongs will keep us perishing or living. That's what the Bible says. So have a real important, you know, orientation toward those values. Next, the view of sin. Remember that, I think it was Woodrow Wilson, here the pastor, when he was president, and the reporter went up to him and said, how'd you like the pastor this Sunday, president? He said, he was good. What did he talk about? Talked about sin. What did he say about it? He was against it. Well, yeah, it's kind of a duh issue, but there are some really kooky or incomplete views of sin out there in the Christian therapy world. Like, well, that's a sin, don't do it. You're acting out. You're drinking, or you're having a sexual thing or whatever, so stop doing it. Well, basically the Bible talks about two kinds of sin, and guess what? They're external and internal, and they're both important to look at. The external sins are the things that we shouldn't be doing, the acting out sorts of things. And then there's internal sin. And the internal sin is our stances toward life, like being deceptive, or like not taking responsibility, or like taking too much responsibility and rescuing. Do you realize that rescuing is a sin? So all of you, slap your own hands, because you're all kind of rescuers. Or withdrawing love. Or whatever. And so, number one, the process needs to have a view of inner and outer sin. And the second aspect of that is that there are two types of sin. There is sin by me, sin that I've done, and there's sin what? Against me. Sin by me and sin against me. And every psychological, emotional, relational struggle is some kind of combination of either something I've done because of my own envy or narcissism or strife or being a control freak or whatever, as well as sins done against me, like being around controlling people or being dominated or being controlled by manipulative people or whatever. And that's why it's complicated. That's why a person's got to be able to look through all these issues of your inner... Sorry, that says inner and sin, and it should say inner and outer. That was a sin. I feel better now. And by and against. So what is their view of sin? I mean, I remember I was kind of surprised when I was interviewing Christian psychologists and therapists back for the hospital program or the outpatient clinics on the West Coast, and I'd say, what's your view of sin? And people would say, well, people are basically good, and we need to restore to them the inner innocence that they all... You know, I'm about to throw up. Like, you expect your mate to think about that you that way? I'm sorry for her. She probably knows the truth. I mean, people are great, and they're wonderful, and they're... I mean, God made a great thing, and we're also kind of wicked. So, you know, normalize that. Expect it. You can relax a lot more when you do. Look at, also the person needs to have some sort of view, and they may not use this word, but they have to understand the concept of splitting. That is generally what brings most people into a depression, anxiety, divorce situation, addiction, or whatever. Some split in their character, in their insides, where they have two opposing parts of themselves. For example, a guy comes in and he wants to be loving and caring and marry somebody, but every time he gets close to a gal, he bails. Can't hold in the relationship. Either, and he says, well, it's because there's no good women out there, or, you know, I haven't found the right one yet and I'm 78 or whatever, but, okay, he can't cut it. And you find out that he has a conflict inside himself, that every time he gets close, he's afraid he's going to need somebody. He's afraid he's going to be vulnerable to somebody and they'll get to know him and they won't like it because he was raised in a perfectionistic, shame-based background. So he has this split. He's got the strong him that's very distant, but he can pull it off and be a friendly, nice person. And then the weak him that he hates and can't tolerate and condemns. And a lot of you can feel that same split within yourself. And they're not integrated together. And so a good therapeutic process says there's two parts of you. And that's why you jockey back and forth in relationships and you pick weird people, or you pick a good person, you ruin that, and you pick a bad person, you marry them, because you can't put your strength and weakness together. That's one kind of split. Another kind of split is you can't put together love and hate. Either a person's totally ideal, or you can't stand them. And you've got these two armies of people in your head. Or people with weaknesses remind you of your own weaknesses, so everybody's got to be perfect. That's another kind of a split. Or you're always the victim and somebody else is always the predator and the perpetrator. And these are what we call polarities of extremes. And it really underlies most personality disorder functioning. And the person needs to be able to work with you on what is your split. So that between each session, when you go home, you're scratching your head thinking, I'm still doing this. How am I doing in my relationships? But if you come in every week and it's kind of like starting all over again, there's something wrong. You should be kind of being educated and educating yourself on what you're doing, because what you're doing doesn't change significantly and quickly over time. It changes gradually. And what is my split doing? I'm doing it again. I get close and then I bail. Or I get angry when I'm sad. Instead of being able to be sad and grieve, I get mad and cause fights. And... you know, get kind of paranoid. That's a split. What do I do that's not integrated? And it just makes it a head scratcher for you. And being a head scratcher is one of the best things you can do in the growth process, because then you don't compartmentalize these issues just in the session and then go blow your life off and then come back next week. You think about it and you ask people in your life, do I do this? And the ones that love you go, yeah, you do it. You're really bad about that. And the ones that are flattery and deceptive and will kill you will say, no, you don't do that. You're so wonderful. You've got a bad counselor if they say you do that. And if your friend says that, shoot them, because then that'll That'll make you more healthy. Okay. I'm just kidding. Don't go kill your friends. That's an external sin, and it's not good. All right. So a lot of this was the whole process of who they are and what kind of the conceptual parts are and how to know what your issues are. Here's some things about the path itself. Number one, what am I on now? Seven? Is there needs to be a path. You need to know in the process what your issues are, what caused them, and why you are, still doing them, and what's keeping it going, and what the resolution is. I've known friends who had therapy for years, and I'll say, how's it going? They'll say, well, I'm not sure what they're really saying. Well, do they speak the same language? No, he doesn't. Is that an issue? Yeah. You should be able to say, yeah, I'm finding out I'm disconnected, or I'm finding out that I tend to allow people into me and then try to please them and serve them. Or I'm finding out that I'm addicted to selfish people because I can't hold on to my boundaries. Or I'm finding out the specific soul breakdowns that I have. I have attachment problems, or I'm not very well defined, and so people can use me. Or I'm very hard on myself, and I'm perfectionistic, and I'm self-condemning. Or I'm always looking for someone else's approval. I'm always wanting somebody else to be happy with me, so I never grow up. Or I'm always angry when anybody confronts me because I feel like a little kid. I can't be feel like an adult. Those are the things. And then the path needs to be what steps you need to take to move out of those. Now, that path will not be, like a series of specific steps. There'll be maybe exercises and stuff, and I think some homework kind of assignments can be good, sometimes not, depending on the person. But you need to know what's involved. A person with an attachment disorder who can't get close will find out part of their path is going to be taking risks to be vulnerable and talking about inner stuff. It's going to be the thing they hate the most. And actually, as a rule of thumb, that's kind of what Christian therapy is. It's doing what you hate to do because you need to do it. So somebody comes in who's totally disconnected and can't relate to anybody but a rock is going to say, give me four books to read and exercise. And a good Christian therapist is going to say, no. Why can't you get close to anybody? Well, I don't know. Give me a book and I'll show you. And they will frustrate the need for intellectual kind of cognitive feeding and say, hey, why can't we talk about soul to soul here, which is what the person needs? Or someone will come in who will be screaming for love and screaming for grace. I just don't have enough love in this world. Fill up my tank, 50 minutes of love, and a good Christian therapist will say, I don't think you use what you get. That wasn't very loving. That might have been the most loving thing anybody's ever said to you, that you take high-octane things from other people and then trample on them, yeah. Ooh, I need another therapist. You don't have teddy bears in your office. We tend to gravitate toward the things that make us the sickest. That's just us. So a therapist is going to frustrate some of our desire to be regressed and say, let's do what's hard for you. You're not here to get more of what you have. You're here to get what you don't have. Speaking of which, there needs to always be some balance in that path of grace and guess what? And truth. In other words, the elements of growth are the elements of therapy. Grace is unmerited favor. The fact that the therapist is for you no matter what, whether you're right or wrong or you're lovable or you're ugly or bad parts of you come out. The therapist's view is I am for you because God is for you. And I am working with him in this. I'm in that process. I'm used by him. That means there's a real relationship, and the therapist should have real feelings for you. It's not sort of like rent a friend. It should be a real attachment there where people value and respect and care about each other. But it's not grace alone. It's also truth. And here's the rule of thumb, and you're going to hate this, but I'm going to be gone in about 40 minutes, so that's okay. If you're not getting confronted every session on something, there's something wrong. At least once every session. I'm sorry. It should be more than that. If there's a lot of grace, though, and you're hungry, and you're tired of suffering, and having crummy relationships, and your insides are being yucked out, you're probably saying by this point, yeah, maybe I could use some truth. And confrontation is a necessary structure. I remember I was working with a couple. And there was a problem, and he was sort of a detached male. I know you've never seen that, but they exist. And she was a passive, wishing-to-be-rescued female. Never saw one of those before either. And so she'd have all these feelings and withdraw and kind of wait for him to say, well, what's wrong? Well, he was reading the sports page. So she'd withdraw for about 5 years. And he'd finally say, you haven't talked for a while. Is there anything? You know, he's really clueless. And so, you know, I was working on him to open up and take more initiative, but I was working on her on the withdrawal and the kind of passive testing of him. It's really your responsibility to tell him when you miss him and need him and those sorts of things. So we're in the session, and she starts to feel some feelings because we got into some deeper stuff, and she starts to tear up. And she's sitting here, he's sitting here beside her, and then on the other side of him is my end table with the Kleenex, which is for that occasion. And she tears up, and she's really getting into the stuff. All of a sudden, she reaches over, and whap! She pounds him on the arm. And he and I both go, what? What was that? And she goes, Kleenex, please. And the poor guy goes, oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not, you know, like... And I said, whoa, 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 whoa. And I thought, you know, she's feeling some things. I shouldn't be doing this. And I thought, eh, forget it. I thought, wait a minute. I said, this is what you guys deal with. Look at what happened again. He didn't even get a chance. And you didn't even, like, bring up that you might need Kleenex. And she goes, well, couldn't he tell? I said, I couldn't tell. Well, doesn't say much about me. But I said, wait a minute. I said, suppose you needed to be left alone with your feelings. Some people do. Some people need to have the experience of tears running down their face because it makes them feel alive. Like I really exist and I have a body and I'm tying my body and my soul together. Some people don't want to be disturbed. You should have said something to him. And, you know, I felt like a jerk in this tender moment with her hammering on this. But he felt better. But then she goes, you know, I do that to him all the time. I don't give him a chance. You know, if he doesn't read my mind immediately, and then we really made it a productive thing. In other words, there needs to be some truth-telling in the thing, not just comfort, because that's where it brings the change. Also in that truth, there needs to be an accurate framework of therapy. And that's a little bit technical, but issues like the structure of therapy are very important. Like money issues, get those very clear. Time issues, how long the session is, when it begins and ends. Cancellation stuff. Pages, emergencies, phone calls. That needs to be very clear because lots of people come into therapy without a lot of definition. They're kind of, you know, they're kind of just a bowl of jelly. They just have never had good structure. And the structure of therapy itself will really help them to set better limits in their outside life. One of the big mistakes I see lots of Christian therapists make is they'll, you know, at the end of the session, somebody start feeling some things and getting into some emotions. And I'll see a lot of therapists kind of extend the session because a person's feeling feelings. What are they training that person to do? They're training that person to, like, not use the time well rather than, you know, I've got this much time. Because isn't that the same thing as our life? We've got, what, 80 years? And God's going to say time at the end of it. We don't have a million years to grow. And so it's a good metaphor for I've got to use what's here. So make sure your therapist has good, clear frameworks of time and procedures and those sorts of things. Because an ooey-gooey therapist is going to create an ooey-gooey person. And if you're already ooey-gooey, you need somebody who's not harsh, but who's got pretty good strict or good structures in them. They can say yes and say no and stick to what they say. Next is... growth versus change. Good therapy involves both, but which is which doesn't allow you to have dyslexia? Which? Growth. Growth must occur before change. That's the whole parable of the seed and the sower. Is there things happen within your heart, and then you begin to be more honest in relationships and open up and feel courage and feel love and all these sorts of things. If a person's only interested in changing your behavior, that's not bad, but it's incomplete. Like, I'm having down thoughts. Okay, think up thoughts. Well, that's like fighting gravity. Those down thoughts are going to take over again. Find out, why do you have down thoughts? Maybe it's because you're a down person. Maybe you've had experiences in life that have taught you despair and you don't have a sense of hope. Let's talk about the hope. Did you see the difference between let's deal with your lack of hope versus stop thinking that? Change always occurs after growth occurs. There's got to be a birth inside. So it's just an important way to look at it. Good therapy makes a distinction between resistance and fragility. Resistance and fragility. You know, some people can't, they get stuck in certain places in their growth and they can't, like, you know, they can't confront their boyfriend or they can't confront their wife or whatever. And sometimes it's because of a resistance, like a stubbornness inside. Like, I just don't want to. I want them to change and I'll change. You know, I get that all the time, like on the radio show. It's not fair that I've got to change. It's not fair, right? Well, let's talk about being crucified on a cross that wasn't your fault and then tell me about not fair. I mean, it's just, God doesn't have a lot of patience with it. It's not fair. That's a resistance. It's like somebody saying, when the world changes, I'll change. It's a two-year-old, and you have to confront that. Some people get stuck because of fragility, because they don't have enough inside of them. They're weak, or they're unloved, or they're self-hating, or they're entirely guilty, or they have parts of themselves that are what we call decompensating or fragmenting. And you don't confront that. You structure that. You build it up. You give it what it needs. And a good therapy process, because all of us have both, knows the difference between when you're in a resistant, stubborn, I'm just tired, I'm in my own self-absorbed state that needs to be confronted, and a person that's breaking down that needs to be treated kind of gently. And so it's got to be able to tell the difference, because therapy moves back and forth between the two. And if you got somebody that hammers people that are fragile, they're going to hurt them. And if you got somebody that comforts people who are resistant, they're going to create a bunch of people who are in their 40s who are wearing diapers emotionally. It's not a pretty sight. You've got to be able to call a difference between the two. Finally, I want to address very quickly the matter of prayer and Bible in the session. It's a big, and it's not as big as it used to be, but we need to talk about it because it comes up. Because some people will say, well, my therapist isn't good because they won't pray with me or because they won't read the Bible with me or whatever. And let me just tell you a good position to have on that. Don't confuse the disciplines with the elements of growth. Don't start thinking that because a person isn't doing specific prayer and Bible study with you, that they are not doing what God called them to do. The elements of growth are grace and truth and time and the process and insight and confrontation and love and all those sorts of things. If those things are going on, the deeper issues, that's what heals. Now, sometimes it's very appropriate. I prayed with somebody today in a session that needed it, and it was a good thing, it was the right thing, and it fit with what God is doing and it fit with what they're working on. Sometimes it can not work. There's a thing called spiritual defenses, for example. For some people who, every time they get close to feeling something, they want to move to a prayer to get away from their feelings. Or when they have to admit something bad, they externalize it and let's bring God into it or blame the therapist. And so the therapist has really got to make the call of, well, is it appropriate or not? And give the therapist some room to do that. Because you don't want somebody who's externally religious. You don't want to create that in yourself. Be externally religious and to be all yucked up on the inside. So there's room in that one. Well, that's kind of the story. Again, the process is one that I believe in. Process is one that we write on our own system of growth. Henry and I do, and there's other tapes we have about this. But you will find in a good Christian therapist that a person who is integrated really takes on God's elements and brings people through a process, and it always starts inside with their character and who God is and moves outwards. And that's how He redeems us, that's how He sanctifies us, and that's how you heal and work through emotional and spiritual and relational issues. Let's take some questions now and talk about all your horrible therapeutic experiences. Yes?
Okay. What do you think about the physical touch, meaning holding for comforting or hugging just to let them know you care?
Them know you care? Are you a therapist?
No, therapist doing it to the client. When the client in question didn't get that physical nurturing need met in infancy or childhood.
I think within certain very, very strict and prescribed and in supervision and lots of accountability situations, it may be okay. Generally speaking, I think it's probably done more than it needs to be. And the reason I say that is that therapeutic touching, there's a lot of dangers to it, like the sexual danger and that sort of thing. But on a deeper level, even if it's non-sexual, the problem in it is it can create what's called a grandiose entitlement in the person, where they begin to expect that they can take a passive stance toward life and toward relationship and be treated like an infant. And there's a small segment of the population this is not true with, but a lot of people, you can create somebody who becomes very regressed and very kind of helpless and demanding. And so it's very, 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 it's something you have to be very strict about. And I would only do it if the person, the therapist is in collegial or supervision relationship with other people and making sure it's really out there. So there are some benefits, and I've seen some cases where it was helpful, but it's one of those things where the dangers are so great too that you have to make sure that that the character diagnosis is correct of what the person's issues are.
Okay, would you say then if the client felt they had that need, is that more of a wanting, or is it really a need?
It's a thing. In other words, whatever the client says is kind of grist for the mill. Desire can tell you whether it's a need or a want, but if a client says, I want this, let me give you several reasons they could want it. I want it because I don't like distance between me and other people. I only feel loved when someone's holding me. And so I can't... See, grown-ups use words to symbolize connection. And they use thoughts and concepts and loving words and these sorts of things. And infants say, if you don't hold me, you don't love me. So this person may be afraid of separateness and unable to metabolize it and use that experience with a therapist to go demand that of everybody else in life, which would ruin their life. Second is a person who is afraid of their own aggression and afraid of their own needs to tell the truth and to individuate and you know, take aggressive stances. And so every time they feel the need to push, they're afraid of that, so they need to be held. And that creates a person who stays dependent instead of learning how to take charge of life. A third one would be a person who needs to have a certain amount of regression and to feel early parts of them come out that the comforting keeps them away from instead of lets them experience. And then comforting becomes an addiction rather than an experience of let's see what's there so we can have it healed. So those are the bad reasons. And there's a few good reasons too, such as a person who has certain what we would call deeply split off parts of themselves that can only come out in that fashion. But again, those are a very small subset. It's like one of those very underdiagnosed and very overdiagnosed problems.
I just wanted to know, I was told by a friend of mine who goes to counseling that it's better...
You have a friend that went to counseling? So sorry.
But,
Why don't they just pray more?
She had a good counselor.
I'm sorry.
But she said that she really believed you needed a counselor with a PhD because that in that PhD part, or at the end of their PhD, they do the personality disorder, you know, analysis, or whatever they do. Do you think it's better to have a PhD, or does it really matter?
I don't know what she's referring to. At the end of a PhD, you do a personality analysis.
That's when you do, I don't know, the work during your PhD work or something. I know.
Yeah.
She wasn't.
Huh?
She wasn't. I don't think she was always really honest.
She wasn't honest with you?
But she had a good, she has a good
Your friend
counselor.
Wasn't honest, or the therapist wasn't honest?
She has a good counselor. I mean, she came
Whoa. You said, I don't think she was honest. Who is the
no,
she?
Not her honest, but I know in somebody I kind of knew through church.
Who's the she?
She, this
Your
person.
Friend or the therapist?
Oh, the friend. So.
Your friend.
But she's extremely intelligent, so
That's always bad. Don't ever make friends with smart people, because it's just...
But, okay, she had extreme loss in her life and came a long way to where she's so functional now, high functioning, you know, has a great job and bought a great house, you know, all that.
Yeah.
Well, she was crushed before, you know what I mean? So.
Yeah. What color's the house?
Let me.
Would it help if I answered it like in terms of does a person need a doctorate, or can sub-doctorate levels be helpful?
Because like I've seen a woman with a she has a master's and she's a really neat Christian.
What kind
lady.
Of house does your other?
But she's not hard enough on me. You know what I mean? Like I mean, I know I need more work.
Your friend got a doctorate. She gets a house. Your therapist is a master's level, and you're not getting the right house, so...
No, my friend... No, she doesn't have a doctorate. She sees a counselor that has a doctorate.
Okay. Okay. There's a question in there.
She felt that I needed to find a counselor with a doctorate that I would probably get more for my money or whatever.
I don't think that's necessary. Let me give you a rule of thumb. Generally speaking, more is better. So if a person has a master's level degree, that's, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. If they got a doctorate, it's 4 to 5 years, maybe 6. So rule of thumb, more is better. However, I know many, many master's degree therapists who are craftspeople in what they do, whether it be marital or individual, whatever, because they went on and they got formal supervision and extra training and continuing ed and did a lot of extra stuff, and they've got a million years of experience. But all things being equal, sure, more is better. The advantage of the doctorate is that you get probably more training in assessment and also in being able to understand more theoretical concerns about the human condition. Master's level degrees tend to be, not all the time, but they tend to be more application-based and clinical in nature than theoretical because you have time constraints. But I know a lot of really great master's level therapists that I trust and refer to and think they're wonderful. So I would never say somebody's not qualified because they have a master's level degree at all. I mean, they're really out there. Yes, whoever's got that.
Is it on? Nope.
Could you raise your hand? I'm kind of blinded by the... Yeah. Thanks.
Is it possible to have quality Christian counseling every other week, or should it be once a week?
Let me qualify that a little bit. In certain situations where it's more of a consulting thing than counseling, I could see less than once a week. Or at the end phases, you know, when a person's winding down and they're kind of weaning off, I can see that. And maybe in some support, real supportive type things where you can't go really deep, but you got to kind of just keep the person glued together with baling wire, you know, because they're in so many crises or whatever. I can sort of see that. Otherwise, my experience has been that life is tough on people. And 7 days in between sessions is about all that anybody can use to kind of remember what went on and have the experience and internalize them and practice with them and let them change them to come back the next week and not lose a lot of ground. And when it's more than a week, what I find is that you tend to do a lot of playing catch up with history. Like, well, so what else has been happening? Because life has got so many things going to it that it's more kind of like catching up with the facts rather than delving deeper into the issues. The rule of thumb is that the more sessions and more frequent they are, the less you have to deal with life and you can deal with the process of the soul. So I think some people can do that, but I think it's sort of a disadvantage.
Thank you.
John.
I think some cases of marital therapy might be okay that way, but even so, it's just so much goes on in life, and you tend to shut down and go back to your regressive patterns in 2 weeks. I think it's a lot to ask somebody.
John?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm an intern in Los Alamitos, and I have a couple I want to ask you about. And he's real condemning, and she's on the other extreme. Now, he's really fragile, and I'm wondering what you're talking about with the structure.
What do you mean by fragile?
Well, he's been really wounded, and he checks out, like looks at the ceiling when he gets confronted. So I've worked on some of that.
Well, how do you know that's fragile? Like, that could be passive hostility towards you.
Well, there's some of that. I've had to really back off with my confrontations and do more suggestions.
Why?
Because he just checks out. I mean, he starts looking at the wall, reading the books, just will not be.
But how do you know that's
present?
Fragility? How do you know that's... Remember we talked about the distinction between resistance and fragility? I haven't heard fragility yet. Fragility would mean that you could tell that parts of himself were being injured, function levels are going down, you can tell that that he's regressed, that he is wounded. This sounds like he's mad and doesn't want to say anything to you.
Well, there is a lot of resistance, too, and you can have both, can't you?
Yeah.
Okay, but he is really hurt easily, I believe.
I don't want to challenge everything.
Okay, but how do I...
But wait a minute. Hurt can also be what we call narcissistic injury.
And I see that.
Where the person, just to give you some psychobabble technical stuff, there's some people who have what we call narcissistic shells that when you tell them they're not the most wonderful person in the world and you don't mirror them and just affirm them, they're really wounded and their feelings are hurt. Like, you know, the guy that comes home and if his wife doesn't stop cooking and say, oh, you're so cute, he goes, you don't love me. That's a narcissistic injury. It's not a wound. It's a wound that the person actually they should experience to learn how to accept reality. So again, I really haven't heard fragility.
Because I've always kind of pictured him as fragile.
Does he want to be pictured as fragile? I mean, does he have some investment that way?
I'm not sure. I just know he just doesn't want to do anything in counseling, which is sounding more like resistance. Which
hey,
I hadn't thought about.
I don't want to do anything in counseling either. let me give you a rule of thumb here. For this resistant fragile thing, because it's a huge issue in therapeutic circles. Fragile people work their butts off and work too hard and do everything you say, and then they ruin their life because they did things that, you know, their engine is going at 8,000 RPM and they should be going at 4. They're not fighting you. They're doing too much. And then they break down and you think, gosh, I asked too much of them. Resistant people say, this is tough. I don't like it. Well, sorry. So that's the difference. You sound like when you are affirming of him, he opens up, and when you confront him, he checks out. That is not fragility. Fragile. I know lots of people who are extremely hardworking, but they have to watch themselves because they can be fragile, and they will break down and go into very deep depressions when they work too hard. So don't look at someone's checking out as being hurt all the time. In fact, fragile people will say, gosh, tell me some more about that. I really need to know this. And they'll take truths that they can't tolerate or bear yet because they really do want to grow and they don't know their limits. And they need to be handled a little more with, like, you know, when the Bible talks about binding up the knees of those who are wounded, they need more grace.
Thanks.
I have...
Wouldn't it be funny if, like, the next question the guy said, I really check out a lot with my counselor. Yes.
Isn't
can you raise your
hand? Over here, back here to the right.
My right or your right?
Your right.
Your right.
Okay.
Right.
Wait a minute. What was the? Somebody abused me over here. What did you? What was the joke?
I'm not always right, but I'm never wrong.
No, I have a wife that would like to talk to you about that issue. Yes.
Kent, I fear that therapy is for the rich, and it seems like you could become codependent, or you're paying someone to be your friend. And I thought a lot of people that don't have extreme issues, I think we're all born into dysfunction because of sin, no matter how perfect your backgrounds are or not, but... a couple times that I have gone, I found that they say, ooh, oh, wow. And I thought, wow, I could go with my close friends and my family. It says, bear one another's burdens, and that know you really well. And a lot of these principles can, if you have faithful other wounds of a friend, that could be honest with you in areas that you need exhortation and encouragement.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Would it help you if I made a distinction between loving friendships and therapy? Or godly friendships and therapy? Would that help?
Yeah, I understand what therapy is. I'm just saying it seems that it's only for the rich, because most of the places I've asked and gone to are anywhere from 50 to 100 an hour. And my niece last year actually had committed suicide, and she has gone to this for 10 years, Townsend and Clown in Minas Meyer, and I encouraged her constantly to go and get help. And the few times she went, she said she felt empty, like just they were, I don't know. And she couldn't afford it, and that was one of the basic things that kept her from it. And then she went through the county. She's a very committed Christian, very involved in church also.
Can you tell me what the question is?
The question is therapy only for the rich? Because what if a person can't afford to pay for that type of quality of a friend? And
okay,
the county gives her someone that doesn't believe in God and
Can I answer the question?
Yeah.
It's a good question. And the answer is, number one, therapy really isn't getting a friend. It is a specialized, highly specific intervention theory that addresses certain character deficits that can only be gotten by extensive formal training. That's the problem, is that when those people who can do it all, they go to a healthy church, they're in a healthy support group, and they've got the counseling too. That's sort of like getting it at all levels. And that is the ideal. Not everybody can do the ideal. You're absolutely right about that. But it's not friendship. And so it's much... what it requires to learn the process of therapy means it requires extensive graduate, thousands and thousands of hours of learning these sorts of things. So that's why you can't look at it as sort of just a good friend. But in terms of the expense issue, that is a legitimate issue. And what I have found is there are two answers to that. Number one, most good therapists I know, Christian therapists that are serious about their faith, have what they call a sliding scale in their practice, mm-hmm. where they have certain regular fee clients and certain low fee clients. And that's part of their ministry. It's part of what they want to give back. And that's kind of what they want to do to do for God, is to help people who couldn't get it otherwise. And I see a lot of them doing that, and I have a lot of respect for that, because that's a high value. But the second thing is, that's also where the church comes in. Jim Gaffney, who introduced this, has, 350 people in regular groups every Wednesday night here, and they've been doing that for years, and people are getting lots and lots of good growth from that. And so I believe the church is filling that gap that you're experiencing between going to a good church and sitting in the pew, and between getting Christian therapy, oh, it's not a better or worse, let me do it sideways. But that gap is where the church needs to come in and bless each other and confront each other and forgive each other and love each other. And churches like this and other churches are doing that. In fact, one of the big things that we do, Henry and I are doing, we're developing as fast as we can group materials for every one of our books for people to come in and work on these areas and learn how to lead groups, facilitate groups. In other words, the church can do a lot without professional training to really heal its own. That's what that passage in Ephesians 4:16 talks about how the body grows itself up in love. We're also working on a lay training system. We've been doing it for several years here at this church, where we train over a year's time non-credentialed people who don't want to be therapists. They don't want to go to school for a million years, but they want to learn how to get in other people's souls. And so that's another thing that fills up the gap. So I think that's sort of like it's a good start on a real problem. Yes. Who's got it?
Hello. Hello, do you hear me? Hi.
I can hear, I can't see. Hi.
Hi, do you have a rule of thumb as to how long one needs to be in therapy? I know it depends on their issues. And how do you know when it's time to end therapy?
When the therapist says things you don't like, it's time to... in principle, I'm not a short-term therapist. Let me be really honest. There are some that are really do good work. I believe that if you're going to go to that time, that kind of brain damage, you go see a therapist. To go just to get a little bit of Novocaine for your soul, I think it's kind of silly. So I believe it's long. I believe it's longer than we would have liked. For most of us, it's longer than we thought it would be when we first came in. But you don't stay in it till you die, most of the time. So it's in between those two time periods. Secondly, when you say, well, how do you figure out how long? Let me answer that in principle. It's probably based on four things. One is how early your deficits or injuries were, attachment or boundaries or individuation or splitting or whatever, how early they were. In other words, if a person's got a normal, healthy, loving, structured, adaptive life and then they have a loss at 23, they will spend less time than a person whose mother was a depressed alcoholic who left them at 4. Okay, so how early they were. Number two, how severe are the injuries? You know, some people had massive losses or massive abuse or chronic control issues with some significant other. And some people, it's kind of like, my family was annoying. So that's a severity issue. That's the second thing. The third is what their resources are. Like a person that is in an area where there's a good, normal, healthy church and good, normal, healthy support systems, they have more resources, and so that speeds the process up. And the fourth and probably most important is what we call the hunger. When Jesus talked about, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. And people who get the hunger always get it more. And they always go better and faster and deeper, and they embrace the pain, and they jump in there because they're tired of living in hell. And they're not in denial anymore, and they don't care who likes them and who doesn't like them. They just want to please God and grow. And I'm in awe of those people. I know a person who moved from another state to a state that had better system of therapy. You know, just got in the U-Haul and moved because her whole thing was, I want to grow into the kingdom of God. And those people, they go for it. And so the hunger is a huge issue. People that kind of dabble in it, and if you ever dated somebody that dabbled in recovery, you know what I'm talking about. Like, yeah, I know I need to deal with that. Anyway, what's for dinner? That is a hunger, but the wrong kind of hunger. It's the hunger for hamburger helper, not the hunger for growth. So the hunger is what kind of determines everything. Well, we have got to end, and I'm going to pray now for those people who may not know about not only Christian therapy, but about Christianity. I want to make an opportunity for somebody to pray silently along with us, because we think so many people. How many of you are here for the first time? That's so cool. Thank you for coming. We appreciate you spending your night. So let's just pray and thank God for the time and then give people an opportunity to become a Christian and ask Jesus in their hearts, because that's where we believe all this comes from. Then we'll be dismissed. God, I just pray for every pain, every hurt, every confusion, and every part of us that is not living in your health and your love, and that you will heal and guide and touch us in the deeper parts so that we may experience life in love. And for anyone who isn't sure about their faith or would like to know their faith is in you, I pray, and they can pray along silently, God, I ask Jesus in my heart to forgive my sins, that his shed blood would pay the price as I accept it as a substitution for my sin and guilt. And I thank you that accepting him as my Savior puts me into his family of eternal healing and eternal love forever. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thanks a lot. See you next week.
To order additional material by Dr. Henry Cloud and Dr. John Townsend, please call 1-800-676-HOPE. That's 1-800-676-HOPE. And then you can visit our website at www.cloudtownsend.com.